Lieutenant Commander Ian Fleming of the Royal Naval Reserve stood on a tarmac outside of Dover, watching a German bomber on the runway. He checked his watch anxiously, then pulled his coat tightly around his body. The fall air could be bitterly cold next to the sea. Tired of waiting, he turned back to the control tower. Once inside, he commanded that the ensign dial the head intelligence office. Once he had them on the phone, he demanded to know why they hadn't received their target yet. Hadn't anyone told him? The mission was off. There were no suitable boats in the strait. Fleming slammed the phone down. This was his operation, damn it. He hated to see it fail. Looking out the window at the bomber, he felt intense disappointment. Tonight's mission was supposed to include a dazzling display of aerial acrobatics, subterfuge, and hand-to-hand combat. And in the end, it was all supposed to result in the recovery of one of those damn German rescue boats. The boat itself was of no use. It was the code books within that were valuable. They held the secrets to bringing down the Nazi U-boat network. But even the information that those contained was useless, except to one man. And that man wasn't even a high-ranking member of the government. He was a mathematician named Alan Turing. This is Espionage, a new Parcast original exploring the missions behind the world's most incredible spies and what brought their covert operations into the public eye. I'm your host, Carter Roy. Throughout this show, we'll explore real-world spy tactics required to impersonate, exploit, and infiltrate the most confidential places in the world. You can find all previous episodes of Espionage, as well as all of Parcast's other shows, on Spotify and anywhere else you listen to podcasts. New episodes come out on Fridays. We're also on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. This is our first episode on the cryptanalyst who turned the tide of World War II, Alan Turing. From 1939 to 1942, Turing worked at the top secret government code and cipher school located at Bletchley Park in Buckinghamshire, England. His genius theories regarding the potential applications of a thinking machine led to the creation of mechanical devices that were able to decrypt intercepted German communications. In the process, he laid the foundation for the rise of the modern computer. This week, we'll explore how Alan began working at Bletchley Park and set about trying to crack German Enigma machines. We'll also explore how the flow of enemy intelligence from Bletchley Park allowed the Royal Navy to gain the upper hand in the war. Next week, in part two, we'll follow Alan as he completes his mission, only to be put on trial for homosexual acts. His heroic work and subsequent mistreatment at the hands of the British government would not be common knowledge until decades after his death. As Great Britain entered World War II on September 3, 1939, it faced a seemingly insurmountable problem: intelligence. Knowing what the enemy was going to do before they did it. In the wars of the Victorian and Edwardian era, a slow-moving battalion weighed down by cannons and muskets could be spotted by a scout on a horse days in advance of an attack. But in World War II, the rapid approach of a German Luftwaffe plane, or the submerged body of a U-boat, a German submarine, could not be preempted by scouts and spies alone. The British would need to intercept German communications. In both World War I and World War II, communication was sent in Morse code over both wires and radio signals. Radio messages could be intercepted by simply tuning into the right frequency, and wire communications could be intercepted with a wiretap. But both sides of the war knew this, and so they encrypted their communications using ciphers. Well, this was not a new practice. Ancient Romans would encrypt their wartime communications with what is now known as a Caesar cipher. This simply involved offsetting the letter in each message by a certain number of letters in the alphabet. For example, the word cat, C-A-T, with an offset of 5 becomes H-F-Y. But by 1939, decrypting German communications had become infinitely complex. Rumors abounded of an uncrackable machine. Cryptology, the study of codes and how to break them, had really only entered into the spy tradecraft of global intelligence services in World War I, which took place from 1914 to 1918. Mechanization from the Industrial Revolution meant that encryption machines were only just beginning to be used, and so the simpler forms of encryption, the substitution methods such as the Caesar cipher, were still common. Indeed, the British Secret Service of World War I had really only been able to crack German encryption after recovering a complete set of German codebooks. If the British were going to survive the Second World War, they would need to put considerable resources into cryptology. And so, the day after war was declared, on September 4th, 1939, the Government Code and Cipher School, or GC&CS, invited its best trainees to convene at Bletchley Park, a mansion 50 miles north of London. They didn't know it, but they were developing the future of global conflict. Information warfare. Alan Turing arrived at Bletchley Park that same day. According to biographer Andrew Hodges, he was put up at the Crown Inn, where he received considerable judgment from a landlady who thought he ought to be doing his part for the war by fighting overseas. It was easy for an older woman, of course immune to the draft, to suggest that a young man go throw himself to the meat grinder of World War II. But little did she know, Alan would be far more useful to the war effort here at this country estate than on the battlefield. At 27, he already had degrees in mathematics from both King's College Cambridge and Princeton. His papers on what he called the universal computing machine placed him at the forefront of his field. As he entered the mansion, Alan was greeted by a mix of familiar and new faces. He saw Dilly Knox, who had been the one to recruit him into the GC&CS. Knox was a well-known figure within the classics department at King's College. In World War I, men like Knox, who were trained in the classics, were well-suited to decryption. Their understanding of ancient literature meant concepts such as the Caesar cipher came easily. But Alan's brand of theoretical mathematics was about to prove much more useful. However, the two men did share certain commonalities. Knox was bisexual. During his time at university, he had been lovers with famed economist John Maynard Keynes, among others. This may have been reassuring to Alan. He himself had what he identified as a homosexual tendency. But homosexuality was still a crime in England in the 1930s. This weighed heavily on Alan, who would have known that the government would consider his homosexuality a liability if they were aware of it. The general idea was that a gay person could be blackmailed by parties threatening to reveal their sexual exploits to the public. It was a secretive enough thing to work as a cryptanalyst. It was something else entirely to work as a gay cryptanalyst. One unfamiliar face when Alan arrived at Bletchley Park was Gordon Welchman. 6 years older than Alan and a Cambridge alumni, though he had risen through the ranks in the mathematics department at Sydney Sussex College rather than King's College. The recruitment of Alan, Gordon, and other mathematical geniuses was indicative of the problem at hand. The Admiralty, the group in charge of the Royal Navy and the branch of the military from which the GC&CS had initiated, briefed the mathematicians on the Germans' secret weapon, the Enigma machine. A series of rotors, reflectors, and plugboards, the Enigma machine was created in the early 1920s by German inventor Arthur Schirbius. Over the years, it was improved upon and eventually adopted into wide use by the Nazi army. It was essentially a complicated keyboard that allowed the user to type messages that were then made unreadable to all except those who had the key. Without the key, there were 150 quintillion possible settings that would have to be tested in order to decrypt the message. The fact that the British government even had one of these machines at its disposal and understood how it worked was owed to the efforts of Polish patriots who had since been forced to flee to France. In particular, Polish cryptanalyst Marian Rejewski led a team that in 1932 correctly deduced the internal makeup of the Enigma machine, and even that team owed a debt to German turncoat Hans Thilo Schmidt, who passed on German documents to the French and the Polish. With that in mind, the Bletchley Park team were but the new torchbearers of a years-long quest to subvert German military operations. Their mission? Crack Enigma. Come up with a mathematical solution to decrypting any German communications generated by the machine, thus allowing the War Office to anticipate every Luftwaffe, U-boat, or land attack. The U-boats in particular were already sinking up to 200,000 tons of British freight a day. This included food, oil, and other essentials. If this wasn't stopped, then Britain would starve. Cracking Enigma meant being able to read messages that told the War Office where these boats would be and when. It was not a problem that could be solved on pen and paper by a classics major, but it was potentially a problem that could be solved by one of Alan Turing's hypothesized universal computing machines. Alan knew that just as a machine could be used to instantly encrypt a letter 6 times, a machine could be built that was capable of testing millions upon millions of permutations in a short amount of time. But if he couldn't figure out how to build such a machine, and fast, then within the next few years, everyone in the British Isles would be speaking German. So as Gordon Welchman and others set about analyzing the intercepted message traffic, where messages were coming from, how often, and so forth, Alan drew up mathematical models to express the idea of this theoretical machine. It was top-secret spy work, though visually it looked no more exciting than a student taking a math test. Alan analyzed the Polish data and found plans for a device nicknamed the Bomba, supposedly named after an ice cream-filled cake dessert, though why remains unclear. The device used mechanical processes that worked toward decrypting Enigma, but not nearly at the scale needed to quickly decipher any and all German communications. Imagine deciphering one word a day when hundreds of messages were coming in each hour. However, seeing that others had also considered a mechanical solution to the Enigma problem gave Alan confidence that he was on the right track. Over the course of September 1940, the numbers at Bletchley Park quickly grew. The cryptanalyst would need a large staff to help them make their vast and complicated calculations. Meanwhile, Alan came closer and closer to a design for a machine that could work through the many permutations of Enigma. His scribblings looked like madness to an untrained eye. Lines led to dots, led to more lines, all fanning out in an array that suggested some sort of science fiction device from the future. And incredibly, it only took Alan a few weeks to complete the design. He called his machine the Bomb, named after the Polish Bomba. In order to discuss the machine concisely and in a way that most of us can understand, we'll have to grossly simplify its inner workings. From the outside, it would look like a peculiar massive cabinet. On its side were 3 panels, each featuring 12x3 grids of drums, round dials representing letters of the alphabet, that were attached to 108 internal shafts. These shafts each contained hundreds of wires, rings, and other materials that interacted with the other shafts. Allen theorized that if a portion of an intercepted message could be guessed at, then that guess could be entered electronically into the machine, and using a series of if-then type deductions, the machine could arrive at whether the guess was correct or not, and thus provide the enigma settings being used. However, guessing a word in an intercepted message to feed in the machine was no easy task. Obviously, if it was as easy as guessing, the whole Bletchley enterprise wouldn't be needed. But again, Allen's genius proved itself as it dawned on him that many of the intercepted messages were weather reports, or, in German, Wettervorhersage. He theorized that he could electronically input this guess word, which he referred to as a crib, into the machine. If the guess was correct, then the machine could break that day's codes. Engineers at Bletchley got to work on the machine's construction, and the first one was installed in March 1940. It worked. Allen's guesswork was a success. Unfortunately, progress was slow. It was still just one machine against a plethora of data, and again, German encryption changed every day. Messages could not be decrypted in time to make use of them immediately. Even still, there was something to be gleaned from a delayed decryption. Knowing of a ship's position from 3 weeks ago was still better than knowing nothing at all. But that was small consolation for some, as in April 1940, across the North Sea, the Nazis invaded Denmark, then Norway, conquering both in short order. Soon after, perhaps most devastatingly, in May 1940, Germany invaded France from the east, while their ally Italy invaded from the south on June 10th of that same year. By late June, most of the country was in Nazi hands. The darkness grew while the candle of hope that was Bletchley Park continued to plug away. Gordon Welchman, who had come to form a solid working relationship with Allen, designed an addition to the bomb called the diagonal board. Again, grossly simplifying, this was a series of cables that helped the machine to eliminate certain possibilities based on the nature of the Enigma's plug board. Everyone at Bletchley Park was motivated and working as hard as they could to improve their decryption capabilities. But soon they would experience the greatest motivation of all. In July 1940, the Battle of Britain began. Up next, Britain falls under siege. Now, back to the story. In August 1940, Alan Turing and Gordon Welchman of the British Government Code and Cipher School perfected the design for Allen's bomb machine, a massive computing device that could aid in the decryption of German communications. Unfortunately, just as the machine was manufactured in large quantities and installed at the school's base in Bletchley Park, the German invasion of Britain began. It was almost entirely an invasion from the air, as the German Air Force, known as the Luftwaffe, engaged with the Royal Air Force above the English Channel. Meanwhile, Alan Turing had reached somewhat of an impasse with his bomb machine. The machine operated on being fed cribs, or guesswords, that allowed the machine to decrypt the rest of a message. The challenge of guessing these words, combined with the constant challenge of the various possible combinations within the Enigma machine, meant that through 1940, Allen was only able to decrypt about 5 days' worth of German communications. Now, this was a huge achievement, but it wasn't enough. Bletchley Park received thousands of German communications a day. What Allen really needed was documentation that spoke to the rotor settings of the Enigma machine. But this was top secret information that only German officers had access to. And if they felt they were going to be captured or killed, their orders were to destroy their machines and their code books. Allen was undertaking top secret work, but he was not himself a secret agent. others would have to retrieve the necessary documents from the field. Enter one of the most well-known espionage figures of all time, Lieutenant Commander Ian Fleming of the Naval Intelligence Division. This was essentially the spy arm of the Admiralty. It was a very fluid department at the time, as the Navy was still largely playing catch-up in this fast-paced, technologically advanced war. Men like Fleming knew that more aggressive, clandestine tactics were called for. Naval officers at Bletchley Park ran Allen's needs up the flagpole, and Fleming took action. He devised a plan, codenamed Operation Ruthless. Delivered to the Admiralty in September 1940, the plan was fairly straightforward, consisting of four steps. Step 1. Obtain from the Air Ministry an airworthy German bomber. Step 2. Pick a tough crew of five, including a pilot, with operator and word-perfect German speaker. Dress them in German Air Force uniform, add blood and bandages to suit. Step 3. Crash plane in the channel after making SOS to rescue service in German Navy. Step 4. Once aboard rescue boat, shoot German crew, dump overboard, bring rescue boat back to English port. It was a bold plan, to say the least. The Admiralty wasn't even sure if a bomber could be crashed without killing anyone inside, and they were pretty sure it would immediately sink to the bottom of the channel. But Allen hoped they would go through with it. This might be his only opportunity to get his hands on German Enigma documents. Fleming flew to Dover to prepare for the operation. Only it wasn't long before intelligence called him to tell him they could find no suitable German rescue boats on radar. The Battle of Britain was still raging in the skies above the channel, after all. It was a disappointing outcome. Frank Birch, a naval officer at Bletchley Park, wrote that when Allen heard the news, he, quote, came to me like an undertaker cheated of a nice corpse. And so, Allen would have to spend the rest of 1940 and the first part of 1941 confined to a small office at Bletchley, refining his machine and coming up with new ways to crack Enigma. But Bletchley was no longer a single stuffy mansion inhabited by six male academics. It had become an institution. Construction on the huts had finished, at least until they needed more. These were ugly, barrack-looking edifices that inside gave the workers the impression of attending summer camp. Allen was located in Hut 8, where the senior cryptanalysts all worked. His desk was a small affair with a lamp and mounds of papers. There was little in the way of decoration. In addition to Hut 8, eventually, there were nearly two dozen additional huts, all housing different aspects of intelligence operations. For indeed, by 1941, Bletchley had become about far more than cracking Enigma. This was a world war, after all, so different teams set out to crack the communications of Italy and Japan. Not to mention, the Germans were using other forms of encryption that required their own teams at Bletchley to address. Prime Minister Winston Churchill, who had only just replaced Neville Chamberlain in May 1940, saw the great value in military intelligence. He was supportive of Bletchley outgrowing its roots as a branch of the Admiralty and allowed it to become more of a centralized intelligence hub. A civilian workforce of several thousand, mostly women, was brought in to handle a plethora of duties. For many, it was a very mechanical process that simply required them to type or operate a machine or analyze disparate pieces of data each day. Most had no idea what they were working on. Little did anyone know, they were performing the work that in modern intelligence agencies is the bedrock of spycraft. Intelligence analysis. The United States Central Intelligence Agency teaches its officers to, quote, challenge, refine, and challenge again. And according to CIA veterans Preston Golson and Matthew F. Ferraro, to analyze competing hypotheses, draw reasonable inferences, and reach conclusions. Essentially, analysts parse the near limitless information available to them from enemy countries and deduce what is true, and then further deduce what is of importance to their government. Well, this is exactly the service Bletchley Park was performing. Workers would translate, sort, and assign priority to different communications, and it would then continue up the chain until it reached the correct parties. There was even a special box filled with messages that were for Churchill's eyes only. But no matter your role at Bletchley, you were to keep your service top secret. To reveal your position at the park was to open yourself up to possible blackmail by German or even Soviet forces. Alan always feared that being a gay man would put his work in jeopardy. Perhaps out of a desire to create a cover for himself, or perhaps out of a genuine desire to lead a quote-unquote normal life, Alan began dating Bletchley Park female linguist Joan Clark in the spring of 1941. Joan was by no means an unattractive match. She received a title of degree in mathematics from Cambridge in 1939. This was the closest thing Cambridge offered at the time to a full undergraduate degree for women. The skill required to accomplish this was impressive enough. The determination required to achieve such an honor in a male-dominated society was something more altogether. She had actually studied under Gordon Welchman, Alan's fellow cryptanalyst at Bletchley who had helped him perfect the bomb, and so her transition to Bletchley was a natural extension of that work. Once she arrived in June 1940, she quickly proved herself more adept at understanding the science of the bomb than any other recruit. As a result, Alan stole her away from Welchman's hut, bringing her to Hut 8 to work on his team. Despite Joan's significant contributions to the war effort, she was paid a fraction of what her male co-workers were. Alan and the others actually worked to get her the title of a linguist so that she could get paid more, even though she didn't speak any other languages. According to the BBC, she would humorously have to fill out paperwork by writing, "Grade, linguist. Language, none." As the work began to hit speed bumps through the first half of 1941, Alan and Joan had time to turn their thoughts to other matters. They would frequently go on dates together to a nearby cinema, though Joan said there was very little physical contact between them. This was not so unusual for 1941, though of course Alan had his own secret reason for keeping his hands to himself. Nevertheless, they were engaged that same spring, much to the excitement of their fellow hutmates. The next day, Alan asked Joan out for a walk around the grounds after lunch. He was likely filled with anxiety at the prospect of what he was about to share with her. Some saw him as being a very serious, unemotional man, concerned only with mathematics. But that wasn't true. He contained a depth of feeling that extended to many of those he worked with, most especially Joan. And he wanted to be honest with her. This was not him trying to break off the engagement. No, he thought they could go ahead with it if she was willing. They'd hardly be the first married couple in England to share an exclusively emotional bond in absence of a physical one. They were walking through an isolated section of the park when Alan turned to Joan, telling her that he had something important to say. He watched her face closely so that he could catch the slightest reaction to what he was about to share. He told her that he wasn't sure their marriage would work because, well, he had a homosexual tendency. She was worried by this revelation, of course. She knew this wasn't the sort of thing you grew out of or moved on from, but it wasn't a deal breaker for her as Alan had expected. She still loved him. She could still imagine a future with him. And indeed, according to biographer Andrew Hodges, they shared a full life together through those engagement months. Joan taught him how to knit. They used meager wartime materials to fashion themselves a chess set and would play constantly. And of course, there was the work, the decryption of Enigma that allowed them to stand next to one another every day and work to get the letters to dance in just the right way on the off chance that if they did so, then they might ensure the continued liberty of the free world. As it turned out, March 1941 would be a pivotal month in that regard, as news came down that the Navy had finally done it. They'd recovered German Enigma documents. Next up, top secret commando Operation Claymore leads to a breakthrough in the cracking of Enigma. Now back to the story. Beginning in September 1939, mathematician Alan Turing served as a cryptanalyst at the Government Code and Cipher School at Bletchley Park in Buckinghamshire, England. His invention of the bomb machine helped the British decrypt German Enigma messages. However, the machine required wasn't perfect. Alan needed more information to be able to accurately decrypt German communications within a day of receiving them. This was essential, as certain military intelligence was only useful within a short window. If the Germans were planning to bomb London within 24 hours, well, that information wasn't useful 7 days later. But then, in March 1941, a raid conducted by the British commandos yielded unexpected results. The commandos were an especially unique unit within the British armed forces. Recently commissioned by Winston Churchill in June 1940 to conduct harassment missions throughout Nazi-occupied territory. In the early morning hours of March 4, 1941, a coalition of commandos, Royal Engineers, and Norwegian freedom fighters descended upon the Lofoten archipelago in northern Norway. Their mission, codenamed Claymore, was to attack multiple fish oil production centers along the coastline. But their ultimate prize would prove to be far more valuable than some destroyed factories. British tribal-class destroyer HMS Somali caught sight of the German trawler Krebs. The Somali immediately opened fire. Krebs was hit with 3 shells, destroying its boiler room, wheelhouse, and exploding stored ammunition on board. The Somali cautiously approached, pulling up alongside Krebs. The commandos swept the deck, finding multiple dead sailors. Their bodies had been riddled with exploding shells and bits of debris. But most significantly, as the British forces arrived in the wheelhouse, they found the captain dead, slumped against the wheel. Clearly, the Germans hadn't had time to destroy everything. As the British soldiers swept the room, they found 3 strange gear-type devices, decorated with various notches and the letters of the alphabet. Next to the strange gears was a stack of books. They were labeled Enigma. The sailors collected everything they could, but soon had to flee Krebs as flames consumed the decks and caused the ship to sink. The Somali turned back toward the archipelago, where massive black plumes of smoke now rose from where the fish oil processing centers had stood a few minutes before. Operation Claymore was a success. Once the convoy returned to England, the War Office realized what the Somali had recovered and immediately delivered the materials to Alan at Hut 8. Alan's work was clearly valued. He was receiving recovered intelligence before even high-ranking members of the military had access to them. This discovery was so classified that even the official dispatch to the Admiralty summarizing the battle excluded the discovery of the Enigma materials. There was always the fear that there could be German or Soviet spies embedded in the government. According to the Facts and Details Project, the concept of double agents, or moles, wouldn't hit its stride until the Cold War years decades later. A mole is an agent of a government that is secretly working for an enemy government. Oftentimes, these agents are native to the country in which they are embedded, and are thus traitors to their own countrymen. It was potentially inconceivable to stiff upper lip Brits who would never betray their country that a fellow elite might be working for the Nazis, or Britain's political rivals, the Soviet Union. And so figures in Parliament and the military questioned Churchill's extreme insistence on secrecy. According to journalist Paul Mason, Many of the elites in Britain were not necessarily even anti-fascist and wanted to make peace with Hitler, which is perhaps why Churchill was more willing to trust middle-class mathematician Alan Turing over the upper-class officers in his military. He was right to be wary. Years later, it would come to light that British intelligence had been subverted at the highest levels by British elite-born Soviet moles. And it was imperative that the Germans in particular not know of the real value of Operation Claymore's discoveries, because the materials were just what Alan needed. The recovered rotors allowed Alan to see exactly what settings had been used in February for German naval Enigma, and even better, the codebooks gave him the exact key for all messages from the last month. By March 12, 1941, they didn't even need the bomb for that month's worth of messages. Bletchley Park workers could simply set up their own Enigma machines using the directions in the codebooks and decode all of the intel they had intercepted in the previous weeks. This was extremely useful, but it still wasn't the instantaneous decryption that Alan was working toward. Being able to read enemy communications from the previous month was one thing. Being able to read enemy communications the day you intercepted them was another. But that was exactly why Alan was working at Bletchley. His skill set meant that he could use what had been recovered to come up with a method that would allow this kind of near instantaneous decryption. By analyzing the settings used for February and the content of the messages, the bomb could be adjusted for accuracy and better cribs could be fed into it. According to biographer Andrew Hodges, by April 1941, Alan had reached a supreme understanding of German naval Enigma. This allowed him to program the bombs to break the encryption of any German communication Bletchley received. And by May, Bletchley realized that there were two German weather ships in the North Atlantic that they could rely upon for a consistent source of cribs. Weather reports always contain the same predictable words. For the first time, British counterintelligence could produce information in time to actually affect the battlefield. Bletchley Park's data put them at the forefront of the war. They even had a hand in sinking Germany's most famous ship, the Bismarck. The Bismarck was the largest ship in the German Navy. It was Hitler's pride and joy. And because of that, Churchill wanted it destroyed. As a folk song from 1960 would later put it, Churchill told the people, "Put every ship a sail, 'cause somewhere on that ocean, I know she's gotta be. We gotta sink the Bismarck to the bottom of the sea." But the first phase of that plan had gone disastrously. On May 24, 1941, the day before Jane received the message at Bletchley, the Bismarck fired at the Hood, a British warship. This shell struck ammunition in its belly and devastated the ship, essentially blowing it up in one shot. For any sailor watching, it was the largest explosion they had ever seen. Nearly all of the Hood's 1,418 crewmen were killed. The Hood was the pride of the Royal Navy. Its destruction was met with uproar among the public back in Britain. Churchill then issued his famous order to the Admiralty, "I don't care how you do it, you must sink the Bismarck." After that, practically the entire Royal Navy and Royal Air Force searched the Atlantic. Following the sinking of the Hood, the Bismarck needed to sail to port for repairs. But the Germans now controlled a majority of the northern coast of Europe, so port could be a lot of different places. And that's when Bletchley came into play. On May 25th, 1941, a young analyst in Hut 6, Jane Hughes, intercepted a message from an officer aboard the German battleship Bismarck to a Luftwaffe general. In doing so, the officer may have just sealed his fate, as well as the fate of his whole crew, because in the message, the officer let slip that the Bismarck was sailing to Brest in occupied France for repairs. It was a phenomenal find for Bletchley, as this was the information that led the Royal Navy to the northwestern shore of France, where, on May 27th, a fleet of battleships and a swarm of biplanes sunk the German ship for good. This time, over 2,000 German sailors were killed. Churchill announced the sinking of the Bismarck to the House of Commons, provoking thunderous applause. But Allen wasn't satisfied with the sinking of a single ship. Using cracked Enigma intelligence, the Royal Navy was able to sink seven more German ships in June 1941. Valuable supplies such as oil were failing to make it to Germany. It was their turn to starve. Bletchley Intel, codenamed Ultra, also allowed British supply ships to sail around known locations of German U-boats. No longer would tons of freight be sent to the bottom of the English Channel. Historian Ralph Erskine writes that Bletchley intelligence saved more than 20 British supply ships and many lives. Winston Churchill later wrote in his memoirs that, quote, "The only thing that ever really frightened me during the war was the U-boat peril," end quote. Coming from the man who had coordinated literally the entire war effort and who thus bared the greatest responsibility in defeating the Nazis, well, this was saying something. And yet, despite this massive victory, despite all Allen and his team had accomplished, their celebration was a short-lived one. Their work already weighed heavily on them. When they were too slow, people died. When they worked well, people died. Their actions led to death no matter what. But only now did they realize that not every piece of intelligence could be acted upon. If the Allied forces performed too well, if every move was anticipated, if every U-boat was sunk, and every Luftwaffe plane shot out of the sky, then the Germans would know the British had cracked Enigma, and all of their work would have been for nothing. Once again, the Bletchley Park team was encountering what would in later decades become the foundation of spycraft. In this case, the most fundamental spy lesson of all, the importance of secrecy. Master spy and KGB agent Kim Philby told Soviet forces in 1981 that he would avoid publicity of any kind. Similarly, the GC and CS now needed to avoid drawing attention to themselves. The best spies only reveal as little intelligence as they need to, and at the exact moment they need to reveal it. Due to the extremely classified nature of their work, it's hard to know exactly how often or with what level of severity certain intelligence was ignored. It is well documented that British military forces would use certain strategies to mask the use of Bletchley Park intel. If Bletchley located the position of a particular battleship, the Royal Air Force would send reconnaissance planes to that location, making it look like it was the planes and not Bletchley that had spotted the craft. Essentially, it was a matter of making it look like the information had been gleaned from a different source. But supposedly, if no proper cover story could be devised and the intel wasn't of paramount importance, then the War Office would have to allow harm to befall their own troops. According to Andrew Hodges, the Germans actually did suspect something after the sinking of the supply ships in June, but they weren't willing to consider that Enigma had been broken. They thought it more likely that British spies had been particularly successful that month. And that was technically true, though their definition of spy likely didn't include a gay math genius from Cambridge sitting at his desk making calculations. Well, this attitude speaks to the precise reason British cryptology and counterintelligence was successful and why Nazi intelligence floundered. The men and women working at Bletchley Park weren't the strapping, blonde-haired, blue-eyed supermen that the Nazis valued. They were outcasts. Queer men like Allen and Dilly Knox, or women like Joan Clark, who rebelled against societal norms. Their enthusiasm for their work and diversity of ideas meant they could attack the Enigma problem from many angles. Hitler's dog-eat-dog survival-of-the-fittest philosophy meant that German cryptanalysts were less likely to collaborate in the way that, for example, Allen and Gordon Welchman had. In Nazi Germany, such an eclectic group of thinkers was more likely to find themselves in a concentration camp than at the front lines of government intelligence work. And so it was no easy task to ask such a thoughtful, passionate group of people to accept that some of their intelligence findings would have to go unheeded. Perhaps it was this moral weight on his shoulders, or at least the addition of it, that finally pushed Allen to call off his engagement with Joan in August 1941. They were on a brief vacation together when he told her that he couldn't go through with it. He knew that he would never be attracted to her in the way that he was attracted to men, but he also had genuine feelings for her. It was difficult for both of them. Sean Wiley, a fellow Hut 8 cryptanalyst and colleague of Allen's while he was at Princeton, suggested in a much later interview with the BBC that he was very upset when the couple broke up. Allen attempted to explain the breakup to Sean, but he wasn't forthcoming with the true reason for his split with Joan. Life may have seemed quite bleak for Allen. Not only was he at war with himself, but the war that was raging across Europe was only going to get worse. In June 1941, the Germans had invaded the Soviet Union, breaking the non-aggression pact that had been in place since 1939. By August, Bletchley was decoding German messages that suggested something more than just war was playing out in the Soviet Union. The Germans weren't just conquering, they were executing thousands of innocent people. On August 24, 1941, Churchill spoke in the House of Commons and made an impassioned speech against the Germans, risking Bletchley's secrecy with some of his comments. He specifically revealed to the world that the Allies were now aware of Hitler's plans for those he deemed inferior. Churchill said the following: "As Hitler's armies advance, whole districts are being exterminated. Scores of thousands, literally scores of thousands of executions in cold blood are being perpetrated by the German police troops upon the Russian patriots who defend their native soil. Since the Mongol invasions of Europe in the 16th century, there has never been methodical, merciless butchery on such a scale or approaching such a scale. And this is but the beginning. We are in the presence of a crime without a name." Winston Churchill himself actually visited Bletchley Park in September 1941, and though he had nothing but kind remarks and support for the group, it's unclear whether he remembered Alan Turing after the visit. He certainly wouldn't be there to support him after the war, when Alan would face his most difficult battle of all. But that battle was a lifetime away, as the nations of the world now needed to band together to fight a war unlike any humanity had ever seen. To lose meant the death of culture, the death of diversity, the death of freedom. Allen's bombs and Bletchley's larger intelligence operation would be a key tool in the effort to stop Hitler. For 2 years, they had been working tirelessly, and now it was time to roll their sleeves up and work even harder. As Allen arrived at Hut 8 on February 1st, 1942, he expected to continue his research like any other day. But as the analysts went about their work, it soon became clear that something was wrong. The machines weren't delivering like normal. The messages weren't coming out right. Nothing made sense. It would take time before everyone became aware, but Allen likely recognized what was happening right away. The Germans had added a fourth rotor to Enigma. There would be no more intel. All of Allen's methods of decryption were now worthless. Thank you for listening to Espionage. We'll be back Friday with a new episode. Join us as Allen works to crack the new and improved German Enigma, is sent on a mission to America, and after the war, faces persecution at the hands of the very people he worked to save. For more information on Alan Turing, amongst the many sources we used, we found The Imitation Game by Andrew Hodges extremely helpful to our research. You can find all previous episodes of Espionage, as well as all of Parcast's other shows, on Spotify and anywhere else you listen to podcasts. Several of you have asked how to help us. If you enjoy the show, the best way to help is to leave a 5-star review. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. We'll be back next week with another deep dive into the world of clandestine operation. Espionage was created by Max Cutler, is a production of Cutler Media, and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound designed by Michael Langsner, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro and Paul Liebeskind. Additional production assistance by Carly Madden and Maggie Admire. Espionage is written by Greg Castro. I'm Carter Roy.